Welcome to this panel put on by the Religious Liberties Practice Group. And any of you who would like to join that practice group, you are cordially invited to do so. And welcome to the Federalist Society Annual Convention. My name is Bill Saunders. I am a senior fellow at the Family Research Council, and I am the chairman of the Religious Liberties Practice Group at the Federalist Society. Well, our subject today is going to be international religious liberties, the promotion or protection of religious freedom. And the reason we're doing this panel at this Federalist Society Convention is because this year marks the 10th anniversary of what surely is a landmark federal bill called the International Religious Freedom Act. It was passed by the Congress and signed by President Clinton 10 years ago. As usual, many of you are from Washington, D.C., so as you will know, as usual, the real story is behind the scenes. And I'll just give you a little bit of the background of that. In the mid-90s, there were a number of people in Washington, D.C. who were particularly concerned about the situation in the Sudan and some of the religious and ethnic persecution or murder that was going on there. And there were also a number of people who worked up on Capitol Hill who were involved in religious freedom work. And then there were the human rights groups here in town as well. I was working for one of those at the time, and actually I know Jeremy Gunn from back in those days. And there began to be a conversation in town about whether something should be done within the U.S. government to stand up for people who were being persecuted for religious faith, because it seemed to many people anyway, not to everybody, but to many people it seemed like that kind of persecution was really unnoticed a lot by the media and by policymakers. It seemed to kind of fall off the radar screen. So there was this conversation on this issue. It grew. There became a movement to kind of try to advance the idea of religious freedom in U.S. foreign policy. And it encountered resistance from a number of quarters, including, at least initially within the Clinton administration. One of the grounds of the resistance to it was the idea or the argument that this made religion a kind of a higher human right than others, and it created a hierarchy of human rights, which the Clinton administration felt was inappropriate. One of the questions behind the bill as it began to develop in Congress was, what would the focus be of the bill? Would it be on, say, particularly the persecution of the Christian church in Sudan, or would it be broader? And most of the people supporting the bill, in my opinion anyway, supported a broad protection of religious freedom. But the bill, as originally drafted, became identified kind of with the Christian right and as special pleading by Christians. And eventually that bill, which had been called the Wolf Specter Bill, was replaced by the International Religious Freedom Act, which was passed, as I said, by Congress and signed by President Clinton. The International Religious Freedom Act differed from the Wolf Specter Bill, which had been the preceding bill, in a number of ways, one of which is, while Wolf Specter had proposed there be mandatory sanctions, the International Religious Freedom Act makes them discretionary standards. It has a whole series of standards, from private letters to banning any U.S. government contacts with the government. They're discretionary with the president as to which, if any, of those he wants to take. But to advance the idea of religious freedom, the International Religious Freedom Act did at least three things. It created an advisor on religious freedom at the National Security Council. It created an ambassador on religious freedom and an office for religious freedom at the State Department. And it created an independent commission called the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. In fact, our own Leonard Leo of Federalist Society, Executive Vice President, is a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. The bill itself, I don't know if the speakers will get into this, but there's always been a debate in this movement to respond to lack of religious freedom as to whether the emphasis is going to be on persecution of those who are being denied religious freedom or whether it's going to be on the promotion of religious freedom. Obviously, the two are closely related, but they're not exactly the same thing. And the bill itself has language that could suggest either one of those two to you. It talks about, obviously, religious freedom, but it tends to define it in terms of avoiding or stopping persecution. The office at the State Department was placed under the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and I think Tom Farr is going to say something about that. Both the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and the State Department's Office on Religious Freedom issue annual reports in which they evaluate the state of religious freedom around the world. This is under the, as required by the International Religious Freedom Act. And they designate countries where religious freedom is particularly being denied, countries of particular concern. Now, this panel today is not going to talk solely or even chiefly about the International Religious Freedom Act, but we will to some extent talk about it. But our aim today is broader, to talk about religious freedom, to talk about whether it should be an aspect of U.S. foreign policy, how best to make it so if you believe it should be. And so we'll look at whether the International Religious Freedom Act has helped in that score, or whether it's helped enough, whether it's been properly implemented, etc. But we want to look at the general question of the international religious freedom and how to promote that. Now, our panel, I'm happy to say, I know all these three guys, and I've got extensive biographies of them, which I'm not going to read. I'll read just a little bit so you can get a feel for them. Now, that I'll give them to you in order. We're going to have first Tom Farr, then Jeremy Gunn, then Rick Garnett. Tom is the guy with the book I just showed you. He is a visiting associate professor of religion and international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He is a senior fellow at Georgetown's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, where he directs their program on religion and foreign policy. He is a former U.S. diplomat and was the State Department's first director of this Office of International Religious Freedom. And after a career of 21 years in the Foreign Service, he left to research and write, and his book here is some of the fruit of that. He got his Ph.D. in history from the University of North Carolina, and he has taught both at the U.S. Military Academy and the Air Force Academy. Jeremy Gunn, who I mentioned, I know from back when we were both particularly working in the human rights field, we also work for the same law firm. Way back when, I was an associate at Covington and Burling, as was Jeremy. He is the director of the ACLU's Program on Freedom of Religion and Belief, and he's a senior fellow for religion and human rights at the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University Law School. He's a member of the Advisory Council on Freedom of Religion and Belief of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. He received his Ph.D. In the study of religion from Harvard, a J.D. from Boston College, and an A.M. in humanities from the University of Chicago. His doctoral dissertation from Harvard on the historical origins of the Establishment Clause was published as a standard for repair, the Establishment Clause, Equality, and Natural Rights, and he has a new book coming out called Spiritual Weapons, the Cold War and the Forging of an American National Religion, which is either out or coming out very soon. Rick Garnett is also a member of the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group leadership, where I rely on him a lot, and he's professor of law at the University of Notre Dame, where he teaches and writes about criminal law, constitutional law, religious freedom, and freedom of speech. He received his B.A. in philosophy from Duke. Parentheses, I don't hold it against him. I'm a graduate of the University of North Carolina. I try to overlook those things. And his J.D. from Yale Law School. At Yale, he served as senior editor of the Yale Law Journal and as editor of the Yale Journal of Law and the Humanities. Before he came to Notre Dame, he was a law clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist and the then Chief Judge Richard Arnold of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. So there are three panelists. We'll start with Tom, then Jeremy, and then Rick, and then we'll take questions from you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate being invited. In order to distinguish myself, I want to point out that I'm the only non-lawyer on this panel. Not sure what that means, but we'll see. You can count me among the enthusiasts for the International Religious Freedom Act, but you can also count me among the friendly critics of the way that the law has been implemented by the Clinton and Bush administrations over the last two decades. The nub of my critique is something that Bill mentioned briefly, and that is that, in fact, over the last 10 years, we have not been promoting religious freedom in any political or cultural sense, but have, in fact, been attempting to reduce persecution. If you think about it, they're sort of two sides of the same coin. However, they're not the same thing. Reducing or even eliminating religious persecution around the world, and we've come nowhere close to doing that, obviously. Even if we did do that, however, that would be the beginning of religious freedom, not the end of it. Religious freedom means a lot more than the right not to be persecuted. It means the right to believe or not believe. It means the right to act in accord with religious beliefs. It's a right possessed not only by individuals but by religious communities. And it's this aspect of religious liberty that I think our foreign policy has ignored to its peril, particularly in the area of democracy promotion. So what I'd like to do in my comments here is really hit on two themes. One, to tell you what I think the source of the problem is and some of the consequences of this problem in our foreign policy. And then, at the end, stop complaining and offer a few positive suggestions, in this case to the Obama administration, in a couple of ways that I think we might remedy the problem. I think that, in short, there is a religion deficit syndrome, a religion deficit disorder in American diplomacy. The intellectual substructure for this is the so-called secularization theory, according to which religion will move to the irrelevant margins of human existence as modernity advances. Well, clearly, that has not happened, and there's no sign in the horizon that it will happen, but I think it is still an unspoken, unexamined premise at major American universities and remains so in the Carters at Foggy Bottom. If you look at the three schools, was that a former Secretary of State? If you look at the three major schools of foreign policy that have been dominant in the last three administrations, namely realism, liberal internationalism, and neoconservatism, all three of them tend to instinctively set religion aside as a category of analysis, as a way of understanding at least part of the world. Realism, represented by somebody like Henry Kissinger, likes to operate at the level of the nation state. It's less interested in what's going on inside the nation state. If you look at Kissinger's magnum opus, a magnificent book called Diplomacy, over 800 pages long, has a 35-page index, and religion does not appear in the index. After a few words about the Protestant Reformation, religion just drops out of history. And indeed, in the 60s through the end of the millennium, when Henry Kissinger was arguably the dominant intellectual force in American foreign policy thinking, it's as if John Paul II didn't exist. It's as if Ayatollah Khomeini was not operating in Iran. Pentecostalism was not moving around the world, and on and on and on. Wahhabism didn't exist in Saudi Arabia. None of these things appear in his book on diplomacy. Liberal internationalists, on the other hand, tend to be a little bit more open to the idea of religion, particularly within societies and within international law. But being liberals, they are very suspicious of traditional religions in the public square. And so I think they have a rather impoverished view of the role of religion in its fullest sense, particularly in democracies. Neoconservatives are thought to be married to the Christian right in some fantasies. But in fact, if you look at the policy of the Bush administration in Iraq, which was the intellectual substructure of that was certainly neoconservative, we thought we were going into Iraq and create sort of a Rawlsian Muslim democracy. I mean, talk about a contradiction in terms. We thought we were going to put people like Ahmad Chalabi in charge and we would have a middle-class secular democracy with religion privatized. Obviously, that wasn't the case, and I think in part this is a result of the neocon failure to put religion on the policy table and think about it for better or for worse. There are two examples, I think, of this religion avoidance syndrome in religious freedom policy. Well, there are many examples. I'll give you two. The International Religious Freedom Act, as Bill said, 10 years ago established, well, it was intended to put religious freedom advocacy at the heart of U.S. foreign policy. And in order to do this, it established a very senior diplomatic official, an ambassador at large for international religious freedom at the State Department. Now, an ambassador at large is not a potted plant. It is somebody in the nomenclature of the State Department who is senior to assistant secretaries. And those of you who know Washington know that assistant secretaries of state are very powerful policy individuals in our foreign policy, particularly in implementing it. An ambassador at large is senior to those. But this ambassador at large was put under another assistant secretary. He was put in the least mainstreamed bureau at the Department of State, which is the Bureau of Human Rights, Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. And despite the justice of their cause, Foreign Service officers don't, as a rule, want to have a career that is involved in these areas. It simply is, it doesn't relate to what they think American diplomacy does. This is a killing aspect of this putting the Religious Freedom Office, burying it bureaucratically and isolating it functionally within the foreign affairs community at Foggy Bottom. When there is a senior meeting within the State Department or an interagency meeting about major American issues such as Iraq, or China, or Russia, or India, where you would expect religion would have a role, the ambassador at large for religious freedom is not there. It simply doesn't compute. If there is someone about to be executed for apostasy in one of these countries, then you turn to that office. But if you want to talk about how we promote democracy in Iraq or Afghanistan, or to consolidate democracy in places like Russia, or to get China thinking about political reform, there is no thought that religious liberty would have anything to do with this. It's as if there's nothing in American history to suggest that religious liberty plays any role in democracy. But, of course, there is plenty of reason to think that, and not just in American history, but in contemporary social science data, in contemporary history, in the history of modern history of the Roman Catholic Church, in the travails that are being undergone in Russia now with the marrying of Russian Orthodox Church with political authoritarianism, on and on. There's plenty of reason to understand that we are not going to be able to implant democracy successfully if we fail to include religious liberty in the center of our efforts. And for the past 10 years, the Religious Freedom Office and the democracy promotion efforts have been like two ships passing in the night, nothing to do with each other whatsoever. This needs to change. One example among many I could give you, Afghanistan. As you know, in 2001, we overthrew the Taliban. By 2004, we had helped broker democratic elections and a democratic constitution, which was fairly liberal. It did have some protections for religious liberty. The persecution, the anti-persecution mentality suggested that we had won a victory in Afghanistan. We took them off of the countries of particular concern list because persecution had dramatically dropped, and that is true, it had. But there was then and there is now nothing like religious freedom in Afghanistan. For mainstream Muslims, let alone the Jews and Christians, Baha'is, Hindus and others, and the Shiite Muslim minority, for a Sunni Muslim majority journalist or jurist who wants to publish an article about why in Afghanistan it is not necessary in the Quran to execute apostates for blasphemy, he himself will be charged with blasphemy. This happens all the time. Our reaction to this is to treat it as a humanitarian measure, a problem, to try to get these people out of jail or to get the charges dropped. We're not seeing the forest for the trees. The issue is that Afghanistan, whether we have the Taliban as a security issue or not, will always be an incubator of Islamist terrorism and radicalism as long as we do not get the Afghans to engage on these issues of religious freedom. What can we do about this? There's a lot to be said here. I'm obviously painting in broad strokes. I would say three things. First, a principle. We need to find a way to get our foreign policy establishment to adopt the principle that religion is normative in human behavior. It's not epiphenomenal. It's not an add-on. It's not simply a private matter like sex used to be. It is normative to human behavior. It needs to be put on the policy table. Secondly, we need to see, as I mentioned before, religious liberty as necessary to the rooting of democracy. You can have political liberties without it. You can even have a fine constitution without it. It becomes a parchment barrier, as somebody once said. You have to have religious freedom protected in law and culture, or democracy will not be stable. It will not remain. In order to do this, we need to elevate the authority of the ambassador at large and his office within the State Department, as the law, I believe, requires. As Bill said, the ambassador at large for religious freedom is the principal advisor to the President of the United States and the Secretary of State on matters of religious liberty. He should not be buried under the Human Rights Bureau. We should have new training for our diplomats. We should have career opportunities that encourage them to get into this field. We should have a subspecialty on religion and religious freedom under the existing career tracks of politics, economics, a very interesting issue. We should be talking to the Chinese and the Vietnamese and others about why their economic performance will improve if they adopt religious liberty. But let me tell you, our economics officers don't think about this any more than our political officers do. And our public diplomacy career track needs to have a subspecialty in religion. I think this is these are very important developments that the Obama administration needs to look at. And finally, we need to develop religious freedom arguments, strategies that overcome the presumption out there in the Arab world, the Muslim world, Russia, China, elsewhere, that all we're trying to do is make the world safe for American missionaries and undermine the majority religious communities in each of these countries. This is what they believe. They also believe, in fact, that we're trying to privatize religion. In fact, they think we're French. I mean, that's a real abomination. They think that we are trying to peddle a form of religious liberty that is sort of this command-based privatization of religion that you find in France. We need to overcome this by developing strategies and arguments, the most important of which is that there's plenty of evidence that if you want democracy to work, you must struggle with this very difficult issue of religious liberty. So, in sum, this issue is not simply a humanitarian issue for the United States. It is that. We need to stand with the persecuted. It's in accord with our values as a nation. My most important years as an American official, events as an American official, were those that helped people who were in harm's way. But this approach to religious liberty is like trying to empty the ocean with an eyedropper, once a day. There are millions of people suffering because of their religious beliefs or the religious beliefs of their tormentors. We must get in front of that problem and begin to attack the structures of persecution by advancing the institutions and the habits of religious liberty. It will serve the people of the world, but most importantly, it'll serve the national interests of the United States. Thanks.
It's a pleasure for me to be here today. I'm not, as someone coming from the ACLU, I feel quite at home here today with so many like-minded admirers of James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and George Washington. I won't say anything about Thomas Jefferson because I don't know how much in accord we are with that particular person. It's a pleasure to be here. I am delighted to have this sign that says Jeremy Gunn Federalist Society. I'm going to be taking it back to my office and putting it on my door. I'm not sure how long I will last, but I will at least enjoy the process of doing that. Tom Farr and I knew each other back at the State Department when we were both working there. I actually worked at the Office of International Religious Freedom before Tom arrived, and I was, in fact, the first full-time person working for Ambassador Robert Seipel at the State Department. So I was in his tiny little office, about the size of two of these tables, put together at the time that the International Religious Freedom Act was voted. So I watched that and then the congratulatory speeches by members of Congress. Now, Tom is, I agree with many of the things that Tom said, though not all of them, and he and I have an ongoing sparring about a few issues. But I think in some of the major points which he just made, I'm quite in agreement with, though I might take a somewhat different take on this. I think that it's important that religion not be privatized, partly in the way that Tom was talking about, and that it should not be looked upon as a private activity depending on what private means. And private can mean lots of different things, but two different meanings of the term private that can cause lots of confusion are, one is private is something that should be behind closed doors, secret, we don't want to talk about, it's a little bit embarrassing, we want to keep that private. Now, that's one sense of private, but there's another sense of private, which means the government is not involved in it. So private enterprise is not something that we keep hidden behind closed doors, but it's very much in the public domain. And we have one of the ambiguities here, not only with the word private, but the word public. So private business is part, it can be a public corporation. So these words public and private can mean different things depending on the context, and I would urge careful attention to how they're being used so that negative associations and connotations with one context, that is behind closed doors, be used to suggest that somehow something like the government should be involved in the business of promoting religion because religion should be in the public domain. That's where I think we would have the somewhat of a disagreement and perhaps somewhat of a concern. Now, rather than talking about religion and private matters, what I'd like to talk about is religion and political matters. When religion is used, or when politics is used to politicize religion, and religion is used to politicize politics. Now, I assume that in many ways we will agree with some of the basic issues involved with the International Religious Freedom Act. So I would assume that we would probably all mostly agree that it is constitutional for the U.S. government to be involved in promoting freedom of religion, just as the United States government could be involved in promoting other kinds of freedom. But that is a very different thing from the United States government being involved in promoting religion as if religion is a good thing. Now, I'm not taking a point of view religion is a good thing or a bad thing. Religion, like fire, can be used for lots of things. I am not particularly keen on Wahhabi religion, for example, and some of the ways that that is used and interpreted, I think, is a bad thing. Now, that doesn't mean religion is bad, but we also need to be careful that religion is not good. So I would suggest the United States government should not be in the business of promoting religion, but it may be in the business of promoting freedoms. And I assume probably to some extent we agree on that. I think we can probably also agree that religious freedom itself is a good thing. Whether a person is religious or not religious, freedom of religion is a good thing. And there are lots of reasons we might have different emphases that we would make on that. I think that religious freedom is a good thing because it respects the dignity of the human being to make decisions about his or her own particular life and what is important, that those are foundational, important moral decisions, and people should have the dignity to be able to decide those types of issues for themselves. I think freedom of religion, partly as Tom was suggesting, would also be good for the stability of society. I think that right now, if the U.S. government were to go to China and Japan and have people talk about how freedom of religion is good for business, might not be taken so well during this last couple of months as it might have before. But the point is still important. It is part of a well-governing society. So although we may have lots of these agreements, I think that because I come from the ACLU and many of you here are with the Federalist Society, we don't want to do too much kumbaya, so let's get down to have a little bit of fun here. Let me begin by giving it, when we're used to presidents of the United States giving speeches of this sort, but just listen to this and think about these words. This is from a speech by the president in April. Our religion is a positive force that impels us to affirmative action. Now, again, thinking, this is the president of the United States speaking, and is this appropriate for the president to be saying? For a religious leader, I'm sure that we would agree on that. We are under divine orders, not only to refrain from doing evil, but also to do good and to make this world a better place in which to live. So is it the role of the president to be talking about divine orders? More than this, religion should establish moral standards for the conduct of our whole nation. At home and abroad, we should judge our achievements as a nation in the scales of right and wrong. The democracy we cherish and our free institutions depend upon the observance of the moral code in private life and also in public life. Freedom for the human soul is indeed the most important principle of our civilization. President going on. We must apply moral standards to our national conduct. At the present time, our nation is engaged in a great effort to maintain justice, and, as I say, the speech was in April, effort to maintain justice and peace in the world. An essential feature of this effort is our program to build the defenses of our country. So we are interested in promoting peace, justice, freedom, freedom for religion, and a part of that is we need to have strong military forces. We are defending the religious principles upon which our nation was built. That is, in our struggles abroad, we are defending religious freedom and the way of life in which our country was founded. We are defending the right to worship God, each as he sees fit, according to his own conscience. We are defending the right of people to gather together. This is in our battles abroad. We are defending the right of people to gather together all across our land and others in churches such as this one. This speech was made at a church. For the danger that threatens us in the world today is utterly and totally opposed to all of these things. Our opponents' actions are based on a fierce and terrible fanaticism. So the president who said that was not, as you might have thought, George W. Bush, but Harry S. Truman in a speech in April 1951 at the dedication of the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church. And the war he's talking about is not the war against Islamic fanaticists, but the war he's talking about is the war in Korea. Now, I think that this language of mixing moral cause with religion, with politics, with freedom of religion, with defense, can be a very dangerous thing. And let me give you some examples. In 1954, January of 1954, President Eisenhower's meeting in the National Security Council, and that was when the National Security Council meant the principals of the National Security Council, not the staff. And it was raised at this meeting in the National Security Council, the problem of what was then taking place at Dien Bien Phu. So the French military in Vietnam was surrounded by the Viet Minh led by General Giap. And at that point, January 1954, it didn't look good for the French, but the battle hadn't started. President Eisenhower was asked, five-star general President Eisenhower was asked whether he thought American troops should be sent to fight in Asia. And Eisenhower said at this classified meeting of the National Security Council, absolutely not, I will never send American troops to fight in Asia. And a couple of months later, he said the same thing publicly at a press conference. Vice President Richard Nixon also made the same statement. John F. Kennedy, then just this lowly senator from Massachusetts, also made a similar statement. 1954, American combat troops should never be sent to Vietnam. A month later, the next meeting of the National Security Council, February 1954, it's looking again worse for the French than it was the previous month, and again the question to Eisenhower is, are you willing to send American troops, or do we want to aid the French in their battle against communism? And Eisenhower said at that meeting something quite interesting. He said, what we need is a Joan of Arc in Vietnam to lead the struggle against communism. And then President Eisenhower said, could we find a Buddhist Joan of Arc? Vice President Nixon, then jokingly, Quaker Vice President Nixon jokingly said, well, we don't want the Buddhists because they're all pacifists. And The transcript of the meeting of the National Security Council puts laughter in there. Alan Dulles, Director of Central Intelligence of the United States, then said, well, there are a lot of Catholics in Vietnam. Maybe we can find a good Catholic. Within 3 months from that time, the United States supported the elevation of Ngo Dinh Diem, a fiercely devout Roman Catholic and a fierce anti-communist. The United States supported Ngo Dinh Diem to be the Prime Minister of Vietnam. And for the next 10 years, the United States supported this man, with one of the arguments being used throughout the years 1954 to 1963 when he was murdered, is that he was a Catholic who would protect the rights of religious believers in Vietnam. There's a lot more to this story, but that's part of it. So the United States decided to identify a religious leader to lead a war against communism, and it was because he was a religious leader. Ngo Dinh Diem came to the United States in 1957 and received triumphal welcome by the people of the United States. Go back and read Time magazine or the New York Times during time of Diem's visit in May 1957. President Eisenhower uncharacteristically went to what was then National Airport. I don't remember what the name of it is now. Then went to National Airport to personally greet Ngo Dinh Diem. Within the next 4 years, it was finally identified. Issues that had been raised by State Department people and by CIA officials as early as 1954, that Diem was a dictator, and Diem suppressed Buddhism in Vietnam. But what the American press read about up until 1963, when the true story about Diem started becoming part of the American dialogue, what the American press read and what American publications said is that he was defending religious freedom in Vietnam. Well, he wasn't, and it became very clear when the Buddhists, remember those pacifist Buddhists that we laughed about in 1954, when the pacifist Buddhists started engaging in acts of nonviolent resistance by self-immolation, seven Buddhists self-immolated. The troops of Ngo Dinh Diem cracked down and shot at unarmed Buddhist protesters. And these photographs of unarmed Buddhists being suppressed by the troops supported by the United States, ostensibly in the name of religious freedom, it turned the American people against Diem. President Kennedy in 1963 finally gave the go-ahead for a coup, not the go-ahead for an assassination, but for a coup against Diem. So that was done in what we did this, the United States, and again, the story is a lot more involved. If we had more time, we could talk about it. The United States said that they were promoting the government of Diem as a move for religious freedom, to promote religious freedom against the brutal communists, and we ended up having that backfire, and it was the religious freedom that put the religion that put Diem into power, and it was religion that took Diem out of power. A similar event, if I could go back to 1954 again, when we started with Diem, would be to what happened in Guatemala also in 1954. On June 14th, 1954, Flag Day in the United States, it was the day that Under God was put into the Pledge of Allegiance, CIA planes were flying over the city of over Guatemala City, dropping down leaflets that said the following. I'll read it to you. Although it went out under the name of Mariano Roselli Arellano, who was the Archbishop of Guatemala City, the document was in fact written by the CIA, although Archbishop did approve the document, it was written by the CIA. So American planes flying over Guatemala City dropping the following leaflet. We raise our voices to alert Catholics at this moment when the worst atheistic doctrine of all time, anti-Christian communism, continues its brazen inroads in our country, masquerading as a movement of social reform for the needy classes. The people of Guatemala must rise as one man against this enemy. Our struggle against communists must be a crusade of prayer and sacrifice, as well as intensive spreading of the social doctrine of the church and a total rejection of communist propaganda. For the love of God and Guatemala. God and country in Guatemala, and the United States then launched a coup helped support a coup that overthrew the government of Guatemala, one of the three democratically elected governments south of Mexico at the time the United States overthrew the government, and the support that the United States used was Anastasio Somoza, the dictator of Nicaragua. Now, one of the principal arguments that was used in support of this invasion, part of the public rhetoric, go read the New York Times, the Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report at the time, was that the Guatemalan government had seized the lands of American private enterprise in Guatemala. So the land reform of Jacobo Arbenz was communist-inspired, and they had seized the land, and that was redistribution of wealth, that was communist-inspired and communist-influenced. And that became the public justification, or that became a justification used publicly, though not acknowledged specifically that the United States was behind the coup, that led to the overthrow of the government of Guatemala. So this land reform issue, taking land from the rich, giving it to the poor, was seen as being something that was inappropriate and against freedom and against democracy and against religion. But those making that exact argument at that time in 1954, if they had looked back just a few years earlier to see what that radical left-leaning General Douglas MacArthur was doing in Japan, they might have found it to be a little bit interesting. Of course, General Douglas MacArthur proposed, and the Japanese Diet did not have much choice in the matter, land reform in Japan. And according to MacArthur's biographer, quote, the land reform program was probably MacArthur's greatest achievement in Japan, and it eliminated the chief source of peasant discontent. Each acre went for the equivalent MacArthur himself described this land seizure as being, quote, extraordinarily successful. Now, the amount of compensation that was given by the left-leaning government of Guatemala that the United States found to be so offensive at the time was vastly in excess of what General Douglas MacArthur gave for the lands that the American government helped seize and redistribute in Japan just a few years earlier. As written by a person who did analysis of this, each acre in Japan went for the equivalent of a pack of black market carton of cigarettes. Then tenants were invited to purchase the land at the same rate. The sum could be repaid over a 30-year period at 3.2%. In 1954, it was seen as pro-communist, anti-religion for the government of Guatemala to seize land and redistribute it to the peasants under a compensation system. That same form of land redistribution was looked upon as being necessary to support democracy in Japan. And I just invite you to look at what happened in Japan and what happened in Guatemala in the 10 years or the 15 years that followed those two efforts at land reform to change the government. The United States government overthrew the government of Guatemala. During the next 20 years, 200,000, principally Mayans, were executed by gangs inside of Guatemala. So now in both cases, Guatemala, Vietnam, and in other cases, as we've already heard in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, religion, religious freedom, religion being a good thing, atheism being a bad thing, were used to justify American policy. And that's where we have the danger when it becomes not promoting freedom of religion, but using the words freedom of religion to promote another foreign policy agenda. Thank you.
Well, great. Thank you. It's great to be with you all. It's always good to be back with my fellow right-wing conspirators here in the Federal Society and to take a break from the burdens of running the world. It was very clever, I thought, for Gene Meyer to engineer the election to the presidency of a liberal constitutional law professor. That should really throw the times off our trail. I have to say, Jeremy Gunn is so charming that I've given him all the secret handshakes and codes. So you're in now. You can take that sign and hang it up. So for starters, just full disclosure, I have to confess most of what I know about the International Religious Freedom Act, I learned from reading Tom Farr and Jeremy Gunn and Bill Saunders. So I'm going to go way out on a limb and do what academics rarely do and confess what our listeners usually know, which is that I'm actually not an expert on this matter and I'm probably not qualified to speak intelligently about the Act's history or implementation. But I do make my living thinking and talking and writing about religious freedom, and so I thought I'd just share with you a few thoughts about religious freedom generally, sort of following on Jeremy's lead, and to talk about the content and the implications and the importance of this idea, in the hopes that these general thoughts will help us think more specifically about the Act and its future and its application. But first, step back with me for a moment to kindler, gentler days. In 1988, 20 years ago, while out on the campaign trail, then Vice President George H.W. Bush was recalling his experiences being shot down as a young fighter pilot over the South Pacific. And imagine, if you can, that I'm now speaking in sort of a Dana Carvey-type voice. Was I scared floating in a little yellow raft off the coast of an enemy-held island, setting a world record for paddling? Well, of course I was. And what sustains you in times like that? Well, you go back to fundamental values. I thought about mother and dad and the strength I get from them, and I thought about God and faith and the separation of church and state. Mother, God, faith, and the separation of church and state. Now, to be sure, this train of thought is absurd. But it is also, I think, entirely American. That is, that God and faith could not be invoked by a would-be president as fundamental values without this kind of awkward addition of and the separation of church and state. This speaks a lot, for better or worse, about how we think about the content and the implications of religious freedom. All right, so fast forward now 10 years from then to 1998, when, as we've heard, Congress enacted the IRFA and declared it to be the policy of the United States to, quote, condemn violations of religious freedom and to promote the fundamental right of freedom of religion. As Tom Farr has put it, this declaration has its roots in the American passion for religious liberty, in our belief that every human being has, by virtue of his or her existence, the inviolable right to seek religious truth, and in our conviction that this right is not granted by the state, but exists prior to governments and to society. Well, so is this policy declared in the Act, are these convictions, are they really consistent with the separation of church and state that so inspired the first President Bush as he was floating in the South Pacific? Are they appropriate for a government that is constrained by the no establishment provision of our First Amendment? This is a provision, after all, that according to Kathleen Sullivan, who has been mentioned by the mentioners as a possible Solicitor General, she pointed out this, or she claimed, this provision not only outlaws a formally established church, but it effectively mandates a secular civil society and a God-free political conversation. The Act, some complain, singles out religious freedom for special care and thereby establishes a hierarchy of freedoms. Well, are they right? And if they are, does our Constitution permit this kind of special solicitude? Well, for what it's worth, I start with a when I think about these matters, from the bedrock premise that, as President Clinton put it, even before the IRFA, that religious freedom is literally our first freedom. And this is not just because it's listed first. That's obviously a historical accident. It's because it really was central, I think, to the founders' vision of the American experiment. Judge John Noonan has argued that religious liberty, as we understand it today, was an American invention, and I don't think we should be afraid to emphasize or celebrate this fact. We've believed from the outset that, as Madison put it, our bold experiment in religious freedom would make us stand out for the better, that it would add, quote, luster to our country. And so the framers, just like Americans today, they didn't always agree about what precisely the freedom of religion means, right? We know that Jefferson and Washington and Adams and Madison all had different views on these matters. But they knew, as we do, that it matters. And they knew, as I hope we do, that our most sacred things, that unless our most sacred things are protected from the sort of the grubby goals of state functionaries, other freedoms are vulnerable. And I don't think this point can be emphasized enough, really, whether we're talking about this act or whether we're just speaking more generally. The protections that are afforded to religious freedom in our constitutional traditions, they're not accidents or leftovers, right? They're not anomalies. They're not sort of cute anachronisms. They're not, as one prominent scholar has claimed, lingering aberrations in our secular state. Quite the contrary, I think. In our traditions, religious freedom is cherished as a basic and non-negotiable aspect of human dignity. And being from Notre Dame, I can't resist dropping a little Pope talk and noting that the American insight into the centrality of religious freedom was embraced at the Second Vatican Council in the Declaration on Religious Liberty, where the late Pope Paul VI said that a sense of the dignity of the human person has been impressing itself more and more deeply on the consciousness of contemporary man, and that as a result, the human person has a right to religious freedom, a right that has its foundation in the very nature of the human person. So again, our Constitution doesn't regard, and therefore our government shouldn't regard, religious faith with sort of grudging suspicion or as a bizarre quirk, something left over from our simpler past. The goal of the First Amendment, as I see it, is to protect religion from government so that it will flourish. It's not to push religion to the margins and to wait for it to wither. As my former colleague and now the dean at Boston College, John Garvey, has put it, our law protects the freedom of religion because the law thinks religion is a good thing, to go back to Jeremy's remarks earlier. And it thinks that notwithstanding the fact that sometimes bad things are done in the name of religion and by religious people. But with all due respect to John Garvey, doesn't every law student learn that governments must be neutral toward religion, that they may not endorse religion, that they may not advance it or single it out? Isn't this black-letter law that all legislation must have a secular purpose? My friend Andy Koppelman has argued that this secular purpose requirement follows directly from a principle that's at the core of the Establishment Clause, namely that governments can't declare religious truth. So given all this, go back to the Act. What should we make of these stated purposes set out in the Act itself? Well, in response to the critics who allege that the Act unconstitutionally singles out religion for sort of special protections, inappropriately elevates religious liberty to sort of the top of the human rights heap, the Act's defenders are quick to insist that it doesn't do that, right? That it doesn't make one right more important than the other. Again, as Jeremy has put it well elsewhere, the Act does not signify that religion should be placed at the top of a hierarchy. It needs signify only that religious freedom is a right that has been relatively neglected by governments and that it therefore needs greater protection. So the government on this view is not giving religion special privileges so much as it's attempting to lift and to prevent the imposition of special burdens. And maybe that's right. Maybe that works. Right? But still, there are a number of scholars out there who continue to doubt that there's really any principled secular reason for singling out religion even in this way. So Jim Nichol has written a provocative article called "Who Needs Religious Liberty?" And his point is not that religion is unimportant, just that it doesn't really need any special protection, because we can provide religion all the protection it needs and all the protection it deserves simply by protecting liberty as a general matter. And in a similar vein, Chris Eisgruber and Larry Sager have argued recently that there really isn't any principled basis for providing religion either special privileges or special disabilities, right? Special and distinctive treatment of religion is only justifiable not because of something special about religion, but when it's necessary to secure equality, right? The equal liberty to which we are all entitled under the Constitution. Well, to make a long story short, I think it's a mistake to reduce religion in this way, to assimilate religious freedom to equality or liberty more generally. And so, taking to heart all the various criticisms that Tom Farr has set out, I am inclined to be an enthusiast for the Act and for its stated purposes as well. It seems to me, again, thinking about Dean Garvey's remarks, that our Constitution treats, and therefore our government may and should treat, religion as a good thing. Or to put the matter a little bit differently, and again quoting the Declaration on Religious Liberty, our governments ought to take account of the religious life of the people and, perhaps more controversially, show it favor. They ought to create conditions favorable to the fostering of religious freedom, religious activity, and religious life. Now, I need to be clear about this. To say that, what I just said, is not to question, I hope, in any way, the importance of the separation of church and state, right? This cherished principle that kept the future president floating. This principle, properly understood, is a crucial dimension of the very religious freedom that I think the Act ought to promote and to celebrate and to protect. But as I say that, we need to remember that the aim of church-state separation, properly understood, is not to radically privatize religion in the way that sex used to be privatized, right? Or to impose a no-religion rule on public concerns. It's to affirm the independence of religious institutions from government control and supervision. This independence, this separation, it protects everyone's freedoms, believers and non-believers alike, because when the state respects the distinctiveness, the separation of religious communities and authorities and laws, It thereby concedes, as it should, the limits on its own power. It admits that there are things that are not Caesar's. It acknowledges that there are some things it, the state, cannot do. And as a historical matter, this concession, as George Weigel has written, created the social and cultural conditions for the very possibility of what a later generation of lawyers and Democrats would call the limited state. Right. So, contrary to the claims of some, the clumsy claims of some activists, the separation of church and state is not a lie or a trick, something conjured up by Jeremy and his friends at the ACLU. In fact, as thinkers from St. Augustine to Roger Williams taught us, church-state separation is a vital dimension of religious freedom. And again, to drop a little more popery on you, Pope Benedict XVI couldn't have been more clear in his recent encyclical letter that fundamental to Christianity is the distinction between what belongs to Caesar and what belongs to God. Right. Now, as I suggested a second ago, many would argue today that the separation of church and state requires governments to scrub clean the public square of all religious residue. Many who hold that view might suggest that the International Religious Freedom Act crosses the line in stating it as a purpose of American foreign policy to protect religious freedom. But in my view, this understanding of church-state separation is mistaken. It's untrue to the vision of our founders and to the text of the Constitution. To quote John Courtney Murray, arguments like these stand the First Amendment on its head, and in that position, it can only gurgle nonsense. Thank you.
If you have some questions, we have a microphone up here, and if you would just come line up before we have any from the floors, any of the panelists want to respond in particular to one another on anything? We okay? Okay. If everybody, you know, we've got about 25 minutes or so. So if you would just state your question briefly, thanks.
Yeah, I think that Jeremy and Tom described to us really opposite sides of the same point, how we failed to fully and neutrally promote religion before the act was passed, in Jeremy's case, and after the act was passed in Tom's case. What I wonder, in a way, is the harder question of reconciling cultures that don't have not traditionally and may not accept the separation of church and state. Are there models under which yet they can still be conceived to promote religious liberty?
Okay, any of the panelists?
I think the tough question.
I was just going to say that I noticed that people started nodding off to sleep when Jeremy was talking, and I don't think that had to do anything with him.
Yeah.
It was after lunch.
I didn't notice that.
Are there models for other cultures to use on religious liberty? It's a terribly important question. It's really a question about Islam, although you could ask it about...
England, for instance.
Well, so far they're not a national security threat to the United States. I say this is a question about Islam because I think that is the key issue. And I think the answer is there better be patterns that can be employed from the heart of Islam. I think that American religious freedom policy needs to be engaging Islamic communities that are capable of seeing Islam this way, not to be theologians, but to be able to discern where there are Islamists and Islamic political and religious leaders who do believe religious liberty is important in Islam. They do exist, but they have their heads down because it is a very dangerous position to take. Without getting into Islamic theology, I'm sure there's someone here who would challenge the notion that Islam is capable of such a thing. But I would simply answer them by saying there are 50-odd Islamic-majority countries in the world. There are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. We had darn sure better hope that they can get this issue right if, in fact, it is necessary, as I argue it is, for stable democracy to exist.
Let me try a slight reply to what Tom said. I mean, Islam is certainly the salient example, so we can see that, and we would be pretending if we didn't recognize that. But I think the problem is less Islam, and it is political majorities that have a dominant religious belief and want to use that religious belief to construct the character of the society. So whether it is the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia saying that what we're going to do is have classes in public schools where we're going to teach Slavic identity, by which they mean the Russian Orthodox Church, or small communities in the United States where public schools could be used to promote a particular religious belief, and where we have clients who are under death threats to bring a lawsuit to question that. So, I mean, that's in the United States where a political majority saying, this is a Christian country, this is how we do things, dissenters should be hung or hanged or whatever. It's the problem of people using religion to control the society. Islam, again, being a salient example. With what can happen with Islam, the best hopes that I have are two things. One of them is to be able to appeal to Islamic history, where if we go back before the 16th century, Islam was the relatively tolerant group. Now, there was not freedom of religion in Muslim dominated countries before that time, so we should not have that romantic notion that somehow that existed. It was relatively tolerant to Christianity, and Islam stopped, and the Western world progressed, but there is something to appeal to. The second thing to which we can appeal are Muslim minorities living in non-Muslim countries. Because I find that religious minorities understand without any difficulty at all the principle of religious freedom. And if you have Muslims living in the United States or Europe or in Japan or wherever, they will understand religious freedom. And they will understand what it is like to be a minority in a country whether laws or customs will discriminate against them. And they are the ones to make the best appeal.
If I could just add one thing in addition to what Jeremy has said, with which I agree. I think it's true of Russian Orthodoxy and majority Muslim communities. I mentioned this in my remarks, but did not go into it. I think we need to learn how to make an argument to those countries that are trying to make transitions to democracy that if you don't grapple with this issue, you're not going to have democracy work. It will either collapse into autocracy or theocracy or chaos or religious violence. This, it seems to me, is a pretty powerful argument that goes to the self-interest of majority religious communities and whether or not they can flourish. If those communities do not want democracy, then, of course, we have a different problem.
Hey, Tom, I want to ask one thing, if you could add a little bit. You mentioned in your talk the importance of religion for democracy, and you mentioned some of the social science research just in passing. Could you say a couple more words about
that? Sure. There are sociologists such as Brian Grimm at the Pew Forum on Religion, Public Life here in Washington, Roger Finke at Penn State, Rodney Stark at Baylor, economists such as Robert Barrow and Rachel McCleary at Harvard, Rick Garnett's colleague at Notre Dame, Dan Philpott, who's an IR specialist. If you take the work of these and other social scientists put together, and they ask the question, what makes democracy root? What does religious freedom have to do with it? The data are almost incontrovertible. Religious liberty, along with the other fundamental freedoms, acts as a linchpin. If the linchpin is removed, then the other fundamental freedoms, we all know what they are, can't do their work because they collapse into religious violence, conflict, persecution, and religious extremism. So the social science data, Brian Grimm in particular has been using the religious freedom reports from the State Department. He's had scores of people come in and code this data, and it is striking to see what's coming out of this. And I think it provides some ammunition for those of us who want to argue both to the United States government and to the Russian Orthodox Church or the other majority religious communities that if you don't get this right, democracy is not going to endure in your country.
You know, it seems to me that a challenge is for religious communities and traditions to develop arguments that are rooted in those communities and traditions for religious freedom. That is, if arguments for religious freedom are perceived, let's say, in the Muslim world, as sort of Western impositions or as kind of godless restraints on religion, they're less likely to take. What has to happen is the argument for religious freedom in a thick way has to be grounded in the religion's own claims. And I think, you know, the Second Vatican Council, the Catholic Church, after a long time, kind of got that right. That is, there is the argument for religious freedom is not the Lockean argument kind of baptized. It's a Catholic argument for religious freedom. And in my sense is the Muslim world needs an argument like that.
Okay. Question for Dr. Gunn, but also for the other panelists. Do you think that agnosticism and secularism and atheism are religions? And do you think that the state should refrain from promoting them?
I think that some people can speak about atheism or agnosticism as if it were some, in a way that sounds as though it's religion, just as people could be Freudians or Marxists and become missionaries for their brand. So there certainly are characteristics of human beings promoting that. I think that when we're trying to look at the United States and see what ought to be happening in the public square, I think the issue is not attempting to denude the public square of all symbols related to religion, which is the language that we often hear. I mean, there are, in fact, people who believe that things in public that are religious should not be visible. So there are people like that, but there are not that many of them, and there's certainly not much of a danger. The issue, I think, on this with the secularism, the agnosticism, the symbols, it's not of whether they are visible in public. Again, going back to the word that I said before, it's not they're visible in public. It is whether the public institutions, meaning the government, the public institutions are promoting them. So I make a difference between the enormous cross that is on the campus at Pepperdine College, which is visible from Malibu Highway and visible for miles around. That's constitutionally protected speech, and it's speech in public, depending on what you mean by public. You take a counterexample to that, the cross on top of Mount Soledad, which is on federal land. Now, that is public in the sense of government. From my perspective, one cross, totally visible in the public domain, is completely constitutionally protected, and another one is constitutionally impermissible because the government should not be in the business of deciding, well, we like this symbol, but we don't like that religious symbol, and we're going to adopt it, we're going to pay for it, we're going to subsidize it. That's the difference. It's not public, it's not public domain, and it's not whether the mention of God is taken out of public. It is who is supporting that, or whether the government is supporting that or not.
I think agnosticism and atheism are clearly not religions, but agnostics and atheists enjoy the protection that religious freedom provides. They enjoy the freedom not to be religious. So I think it's sometimes it's a detour to ask, well, is atheism a religion? It doesn't really matter. Atheists enjoy religious freedom just like everybody else does. Religious freedom includes the freedom to say no.
I agree that they are not religions. I also agree with Rick Garnett and John Garvey that the American understanding of religious freedom is grounded in the notion that religion is good. If our system of religious freedom were grounded in agnosticism or atheism, we would have no protection for religious people under that rubric of religious freedom, or certainly less protection.
Oh, well, I strongly disagree with that. If you have people who are hostile to religion making the decisions, perhaps, but if you have people who will say, look, for government-sponsored, so when we mean by public, the government shouldn't be taking a position for agnosticism, anti-agnosticism, for secularism, or for atheism, or opposed to atheism, promoting one religion or promoting 10 religions or all religions. It is, again, for me, it goes to the point, and I take this from a non-religious perspective, it is respecting the dignity of human beings to be making these decisions for themselves. And you don't need to believe in God or five gods or no God in order to believe that human beings have the right to make and exercise those decisions.
I'm going to assume the unfamiliar role of the thoughtful moderate and be somewhere in between these two, because it seems to me that even a political community that didn't agree with John Garvey about the goodness of religion could still provide meaningful protections to religious freedom for the reasons that Jeremy says. You know, in my view, though, a political community that sees religion as part of human flourishing, as a basic human good, is more likely to provide better protection to religious freedom. But I don't think it's a it's so much an either-or thing.
Okay, next.
In studying Islam, I was struck by the discrepancy between the largely successful demands by Muslims in the West for equal, in some cases even preferential treatment, and the absolute lack of equal treatment for members of other religions in most Muslim countries, which of course is underpinned by the fact that under traditional Islam, the idea of a secular state ruled by man-made laws under which Islam is merely one of many equal religions just does not exist. I'd like to ask the panel, what teeth, if any, do you think the Religious Freedom Act should be given or should be applied to make countries like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Egypt, over whom we might have some influence, comply with its provisions? Should it be trade sanctions? Should it be applying some principle of reciprocity, as in trade negotiations? If you don't allow non-Muslim churches, we will not allow you to spend billions here to establish Wahhabi centers, or something else?
Well, in fact, I'm sure Jeremy will want to comment on this, but in fact, the Religious Freedom Act does provide for this kind of thing and economic sanctions that can be, but never have been, levied against Saudi Arabia or some of these other countries, Iran, in order to produce reciprocity, as you put it, or to achieve other ends. My own view, and you note that I say we have it as a possibility. When you're put on one of these lists, the countries of particular concern list, the Secretary of State must consider strong economic sanctions of the kind you're suggesting. They have been considered. They've never been used. My own view, and if there's anything worse than economic unilateral economic sanctions, which in my view don't work, it is threatening them and never using them. It debases the coinage, and it's really sort of a spent force, in my view, this whole CPC process. But I think the real answer to your question is that we're never going to get the lands of Islam to adopt religious freedom by these kinds of measures. We have got to do what Rick Garnett was referring to, and that is to find those who can speak from the heart of their own truth claims and who can see it within their own interests to move in this direction. I think they exist in every country, including Saudi Arabia, but we don't have the discernment, we don't have the policy, we don't have the understanding to do that. It's so hard that only a fool would try it unless it were in our national security interests, and I believe it to be.
You know, just to highlight what a challenge this is, I mean, we've been talking about the Muslim world, but it strikes me that at the top of any list of religious freedom violators would be China. And it just seems to me unlikely, looking at the last couple decades, that there's the political will to do anything more than kind of say please, pretty please during Olympics commercials to try to get China to improve its record on religious freedom.
I also am skeptical about the use of force or threat of force to try and get countries to change domestic policies. And I just say, look at the United States. How well would the United States respond to one or more foreign countries saying, you should change your constitution, or if you don't, we will boycott you or do something? I think the reaction from most Americans would be, to hell with you. It wouldn't be, oh, okay, let's see how we can change the laws. And I think when you get to something related to religion, which goes often very close to the core of the national identity, and it's often part of the core of the identity in the United States, for one country to be saying to another, change your identity in order for you to have our good graces, you're not likely to be successful. The key would be, I think we're not going to have religious freedom in China or in Sudan or in Saudi Arabia until the people of the country themselves, the countries themselves, would want that to be. And the goal that we need to be doing for the United States would need to be promoting ways that we can help people within the country do that, recognizing this could be a long road and we're not going to have much to show for it in likelihood. One last point. The argument that you make about many Islamic countries not respecting freedom of religion to some extent is exactly the kind of counterexample that I would make on the argument that, well, countries that have a deep respect for religion are more likely to have religious freedom. To that I say, no, that's not true. It depends. And there's going to be more respect for religious freedom in the United States, which is relatively less religious than is Saudi Arabia, and thank God for that.
relatively less religious, and more of a respect for human dignity, which I think once again is the core, and it's the human dignity to make a decision to believe in God and to manifest belief in God, which is core, and respect for human dignity to say, I don't believe in God, and I don't believe in this. The society needs to be protecting both equally.
I think Jeremy's answer underscores a very important point, which is that the project of promoting and protecting religious freedom around the world shouldn't be, and in my view need not be, seen as the U.S. demanding that other countries change their identity. Instead, in many cases, all we're doing is asking them to comply with international agreements to which they're signatories, right?
I want to add just two things. Perhaps the chief reason the Wolf-Specter bill failed and we ended up with the International Religious Freedom Act was because Wolf-Specter had mandatory sanctions, and the business community and others in the U.S. just turned out in force, to stop it. So practically, could you have more tougher sanctions? It's hard to get them through the Congress of the United States. But I think, whatever you decide about how you want to deal with this religious freedom issue, part of the background of it is it being treated the same way that other human rights were being treated in the U.S. government's promotion or protection of those rights? And so just don't section it off. If you support sanctions for some other human right violation, it seems to me you should also for religious freedom violation. Okay.
Well, I have a related question, I guess, for Mr. Farr. I see the text or the subtext of your remarks as saying it's the mission of the United States to make the world safe for democracy, and one way to do it is to promote religious freedom. And I'd like you to explain why it's the mission of the United States to make the world into anything other than safe for America. And secondly, in terms of the boots on the ground, we've been in Iraq for 5 years now, over 5 years. And is a Christian better off now or better off under Saddam Hussein?
It's the mission of the United States to advance American interests and protect the security of the American people. Democracy promotion after 9/11, in my view, became far more of a national security imperative than it was in 1982 when President Reagan gave the famous Westminster speech in which he said it was a national security issue. I believe that President George W. Bush was right to this extent in his democracy promotion freedom agenda, that the only way we are going to defeat Islamist terrorism over the long run is to implant stable democracies in those countries where it is incubated and exported. If we don't succeed in doing that, then we are not defending ourselves as we should. Now, if you don't buy that, then you won't buy my argument. My argument is we are not going to succeed in highly religious societies in advancing democracy unless we put religious freedom at the center of the effort. So we may disagree. It's not a matter of making the world safe for democracy. It is a matter of making America safe by encouraging democracies in those countries where 9/11-type events germinate. As far as Iraq is concerned, clearly Christians are far worse off today than they were under Saddam Hussein. There's no question about it. I think there were, 1,800,000 Christians in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Maybe half of those have fled the country. A few are coming back. But for the most part, those that can leave have left. They are under terrible stress. And I think it is one of the unfortunate failures of this administration not to have given this issue more emphasis than it has. But over the long run, the only solution, and I'm sure you would agree, is not to return to the kind of autocracy that Saddam Hussein represented, but to move Iraq toward a country that does respect religious freedom. And that is not going to happen unless our diplomacy changes. It is not simply a matter of American troops on the ground.
Okay, next, please.
Hi, I have a question for the panel, but also for Professor Farr in particular. I also had a question about Iraq. And I was curious, in light of what you said about how we have to work with countries and acknowledge that they have a religious base, what you thought about the Sharia clause in the Iraqi constitution. Does that comport or violate the International Freedom Religious Act? And also, could you comment a little bit about the tensions of that particular clause and the democracy clause that follows it?
Well, I think you're referring to the clause that says no law can be, what's the phrase?
No law can be passed that's inconsistent with Sharia.
Yeah, there's another word for it. But yeah, inconsistent with Sharia, inconsistent with Islam. Clearly, this is a contravening of international commitments to religious freedom, to any sane understanding of religious freedom. It says, in effect, the Afghan constitution is the same thing. It says, everyone in this country has religious freedom, period, except to the extent that it contravenes Islamic law. And then, of course, the question is who decides, and here we get into a problem of American jurisprudence as well. It tends to be judges who decides this. In the case of Iraq, it is those trained in Islamic jurisprudence rather than in the broader kinds of training my point of view is that these should be decided by legislatures anyway. That kind of clause should not be there. We accepted it. We, the United States government, accepted it. This is I'm going to praise, uncharacteristically praise the State Department. They tried to fight this a bit. But at the end of the day, it simply wasn't going to happen. You weren't even going to have the other phrases in there, the other protections for religious liberty, without this inconsistency clause. So the question is, can we move forward from here? Can we get the Iraqis to see this is a problem for them? That's the issue. That's the goal. It is a problem for them, unless they not only get that clause out of the Constitution, but far more importantly, understand that if they continue to have these severe restrictions on religious liberty, they're always going to have religious violence in that country. They're never going to have a stable democracy. I hope that.
Well, am I incorrect in my understanding that it was us and Noah Feldman and President Bush that it was their idea to insert this? Am I incorrect on that?
I would blame Noah Feldman for a number of things, but not for that. I think
he's taking credit for it.
For those of you who don't know, Noah Feldman was, who's now at Harvard, was an advisor to the constitutional group under the early Bush administration, under Jerry Bremer and his predecessor there. And I think, in retrospect, he has tried to make the case that this is not a contravention of fundamental understandings of religious freedom. And what he wants to do is reinterpret Sharia in a positive sense. I mean, I'm all for that, too. I think that Muslims have to do that. But I don't think you do it by putting it in the Constitution. And then, I mean, it's going in the back door. It's the wrong way to do it.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, it's perfect. Thank the panel, please.